We all know Shakespeare was a genius, a writer par excellence, and the gold standard to all who came after. But our guest this morning says Shakespeare was far more than a literary giant. Stephen March says Shakespeare is the most influential person of all time. And he's with us this morning to tell us why and to track Shakespeare's influence through history and culture. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm glad to be with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Stephen March. He's an author and journalist, and he currently writes a column for Esquire magazine. His new book is called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And we're looking forward to taking your phone calls this morning, too. Why do you think Shakespeare is so present today? And just how influential do you think he is? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. You can also like this show on Facebook, too. Just look for The Veronica Rickard Show on wpr.org.
My mother did but duty. Such, my lord, as you owe to your wife.
No more of that. I prithee, do not strive against my vows. I was compelled to her. But I love thee by love's own sweet constraint, and will forever do thee all rites of service.
Aye, so you serve us till we serve you. But when you have our roses, you barely leave our thorns to prick ourselves and mock us with our bareness.
A clip there from All's Well That Ends Well. And Stephen March, I'm so glad you could join us today.
Hello?
Hi, are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I don't know if you heard that clip from All's Well That Ends Well, but it's the kind of thing we hear and we kind of sigh. We hear that beautiful cadence, that rich language. And I think everyone can agree, Shakespeare is an amazing writer, the best writer probably in all of history. But what about the claim that he's the most influential person of all time?
Well, you know, when I started writing this book, I sort of wanted to write a book about Shakespeare's impact on popular culture, on Hollywood, on Bollywood, in pop songs and things like that. And then slowly, sort of against my will, as I was writing it, I sort of noticed all these material consequences cropping up that seemed very unusual to me. I mean, he changed our sex lives, he changed race, he shows up at these weird moments in American history, like the introduction of the Starling to North America, and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, it is not to me that connected to his quality as a writer. I mean, that's one of the things that's quite interesting. I mean, there are a lot of brilliant writers out there. There are a lot of genius writers out there as well. Well, not a lot, but, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I wish there were more. But, you know, Shakespeare had this immense impact on history that someone like Dante did not have.
So when you say that it's not so much Shakespeare as a writer, I mean, granted, he's a brilliant writer. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that it's more of the way he thought, the depth of his ideas and the richness of his thinking?
No. I mean, because there are a lot of writers with a lot of interesting thinking. I think it has to do with this weird kind of mania he inspires, as well as, you know, I mean, this may sound like such a weak answer, but I think it is. You know, accident is one of the forces in history that's, you know, never really taken seriously. But he had this immense impact because of a lot of forces that were, you know, unpredictable and chaotic. That's part of why he had this immense impact.
Well, giving us a few examples, can you give us a sense of the range?
Sure. I mean, let me tell you, to me, what's the iconic story of this book. So starlings, Wisconsin must have millions of them. Yeah?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
I mean they're everywhere. They're the worst. One of the worst introduced species into North America. They're incredibly destructive of native species, particularly bluebirds and red-headed blackbirds. And, you know, I mean, literally the skies of the American prairie would be full of bluebirds if not for starlings. They also have all these economic impacts on urban areas and farming and so on. You know, the reason there are starlings in North America is because a Shakespeare fan named Eugene Shifflin decided that he was going to introduce every bird mentioned in Shakespeare to North America. And so he took 60 pairs of starlings to Central Park in 1890, and release them. And he'd done this with a bunch of other birds, and they just died out. But the starlings stayed, and from those 60 pairs, there are now 200 million individual starlings in North America, and they keep spreading. They haven't yet finished their range of their destruction. So they go from the Arctic Circle to the Gulf of Mexico, but they're still expanding.
Mm.
You know, this is not something that this comes from one line in Henry IV, Part One.
Yeah, one line that a lot of people wish he maybe hadn't written.
Yeah, I mean, if he hadn't written that line, you know, you wouldn't have to be so careful with your garbage. This is the kind of impact that he's had on a whole host of moments in history that he could never have predicted.
Tell us about one or two more.
Well, the big one, you know, the one that I found most fascinating because it's sort of, I mean, it's such an easy subject to become obsessed with, and so many people do, is the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, which to me is this, you know, one of the key moments in American history, the first president assassinated, creating the Lincoln Memorial in Washington and so on. And, you know, the Booth brothers, John Wilkes and Edwin, and Lucius Brutus Jr. were Shakespeare actors, and the statue to Shakespeare in Central Park was raised. The money for it was raised by them putting on Julius Caesar in New York about 6 months before Lincoln was assassinated. And you know, when you think about the assassination of Lincoln, when you think about how he was killed, the dramatics of how he was killed, how the assassination was this work of political theater, that work of political theater is from Julius Caesar. I mean, it is like John Wilkes Booth is lifting it from Julius Caesar. You know, first of all, you know, the reasons for his loyalty to the South, John Wilkes, rather than Edwin, who was the great American actor of his generation and had his career ruined in part by John Wilkes, had to do with their father, who was this great actor, this great champion of American liberty. And because of him, they could each make a career as actors, but they had to do it in different regions of the country. So Edwin took the North, John Wilkes took the South, and the other brother took the West. And so that's why John Wilkes was Southern. And, you know, when you think about how John Wilkes assassinated Lincoln, so he shoots him, then he jumps on stage. Already, you know, it happens in a theater, it happens on stage. He shouts out Sic Semper Tyrannis, which is the Virginia state motto, thus ever to tyrants. He speaks in Latin, just as Julius Caesar, when he's assassinated, speaks in Latin for the only moment in the play, A tu Brute. Then when John Wilkes flees and he's, you know, on the hunt, he's being hunted by the feds, you know, he writes in his diary, I am being hounded over the country for doing what Brutus was honored for. He was very conscious of Brutus the entire time. And, even his father's middle name was Brutus.
Mm.
So you have this, as I say in the book, it's not really just a scene. It's sort of a scene written by Shakespeare, the Lincoln assassination. It becomes this kind of incredibly powerful moment, which the theatrics of it are given to John Wilkes by Shakespeare.
So you think if it had just been John Wilkes Booth ambushing Lincoln in a dark alley, it wouldn't have the resonance that it has because it had all this extra dramatic weight?
Yeah, well, I don't think John Wilkes would have wanted to do that, right? I mean, John Wilkes didn't want, he was not a, you know, these are very down-market assassins, you know. Like, he wanted to be a spectacular hero. I mean, that's even more important than the terroristic iconography that he conjured. It's more that he wanted to be a hero like Brutus. He saw his model, his dramatic model, from Shakespeare, and he found, as well as finding his dramatic means from Shakespeare. So I think, yeah, I mean, he would never have killed Lincoln in a dark alley. You know, he could only have killed him really in a theater.
Wow. Well, there's another example from this Lincoln assassination that sends shivers up your spine. Apparently, Lincoln was quoting from the play in which the word assassination was coined.
Yeah.
Very really close weird, to his right? his assassination at the hands of Booth.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think of that moment. He's going up the Potomac, you know, with Charles Sumner. And I think, you know, he's reciting Shakespeare in a large measure not to talk to anybody about politics, you know, not to have to, you know, do more horse trading. And they're reading passages from Macbeth, including the passage that in which the word assassination is coined in Shakespeare, in Macbeth, in that play. And, you know, I don't think he, well, I mean, the ironies are just so manifest. I mean, the thing is, I think he was the first president to be assassinated. So every president after him has kind of had in their mind that they could be assassinated. But I don't think even in the war, I mean, I guess maybe he did think he might be assassinated. But I don't know. It's one of those incredibly strange ironies that this book is. I mean, that's what this book is made up of, these weird moments that Shakespeare shows up completely where you wouldn't expect him.
You know, it's interesting. The two examples we've talked about, the Starlings and the assassination of Lincoln, those are rather dark examples. So I guess the influence of Shakespeare can spin off in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah.
And I guess this one's ambiguous, but you claim that Shakespeare invented teenagers.
Yeah, I know that sounds really weird when I say that. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm saying he invented the spring or something like that, but you have to understand that, in you know, when you read Arria's History of Childhood in the Middle Ages, and you know all the research onto these questions, you know, in the pre-Renaissance era, there really was no conception of adolescence. There was really childhood and adulthood, and it was sort of like a bar mitzvah. You know, I mean, you're one thing today, tomorrow you're a man. You know, this sort of thing, and you know, Shakespeare with Romeo and Juliet, which is the greatest hit play of all time. I mean, it has never gone out of fashion. It has been turned into 100 ballets, you know, 100 operas. It's the most adapted work for Hollywood.
Hmm.
There are cigars named after it. I mean, it's incredibly popular. And it arrived so early in this movement towards adolescence and so completely defines exactly what an adolescent is, even to our contemporary conception. Like, even, you know, I mean, the opening scene of the play are two gangs of teenagers who get into a dangerous brawl because basically one of them gives the other one the finger, right? I mean, these kind of scare stories about teenagers, I mean, you could probably read one in the Miami Herald today. You know what I mean?
Mm.
I mean, they're very, very common. Also, you know, for example, Juliet is 13 at the beginning of the play, 2 weeks from her 14th birthday, which it makes us squirm. You know, yeah. I mean, unless you're a Polish film director, 13 is too young for the beginning of a love affair.
Yeah.
But that's the eternal question of adolescence, right? I mean, how young is too young? And, you know, the way that these characters are portrayed with this kind of immense love, immense attraction, as well as sort of being ridiculous people.
Well, the emotions are bigger than life, and that's the way it feels when you're a teenager.
Yeah, and they're also they're fantastic, but also stupid. You know, this is, you know, enviable, but also disgusting. This is the sort of the combination of love and, you know, this love and hate pull we still have, you know, our culture still has for teenagers. And it's all there in Romeo and Juliet, and it is spread everywhere through that play.
And we've got a clip of Romeo and Juliet. Let's listen.
Good pilgrim, you'd wrong your hand too much. Which mannerly devotion shows in this? For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
Have not saints lips and holy palms too?
Aye, pilgrim, lips that they must use in prayer.
Oh, then, dear saint, let lips do what hands do. They pray. grant thou, lest faith turn to despair.
Saints, do not move, though grant for prayer's sake.
Then move not. While my prayer's effect I take, thus, from my lips, by thine, my sin is purged.
A clip from Romeo and Juliet. That's one of those dramatic, over-the-top moments that you can relate to if you think back to being a teenager. Well, what do you hear when you hear that clip?
Well, that clip is, you know, you probably didn't notice, no one will notice, but it's in a sonnet form. So it actually has A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G rhyme scheme. So the teenagers in this moment, they literally burst into this lyrical form. And that's perfect. You know, it's funny. In the 18th century and the 19th century, they cut that bit because it seemed too ridiculous. It seemed too much. But you know, I love it. I mean, I think it's perfect because it's exact. I love that line, like you kiss by the book. Like this 13-year-old girl has never kissed anything. Like, yeah, she knows, right? She's been kissing all the, like, it's such a perfect line. It's like, that's exactly how you are when you're 14. You think like, oh yeah, I've been kissing all the time. You know, I know what a kiss is. It's a magical passage. It's one of those things that only Shakespeare can do where he like suddenly just like, you know what? I'm going to make this scene a sonnet. No one will notice, but I'm going to make it a sonnet.
Well, and I guess in lesser hands, it might be a little too cheeseball, but with Shakespeare, it works.
Oh, no, I think it is cheeseball. But, I mean, I think unless you get that teenagers are cheeseball, you know, you're missing a huge part of being a teenager. Like, that's what's so wonderful about them, that they are cheesy. I think that's why this device works so beautifully.
So is that why you think that this is Shakespeare's greatest hit? Do you think because people like that over-the-top emotion, or is there more?
Well, you know, I mean, Shakespeare wrote amazing plays about all stages of life. You know, I mean, I just saw The Winter's Tale the other day, which is this incredible story about, you know, people falling in love again at the age of 50, right? And this comedy of restored marriage that I think is just, wonderful and incredibly rare. I mean, you know, you don't really see or read about that kind of that experience of life anymore. I think the attraction of Romeo and Juliet, what I'm trying to say, is that it's just because we love being around dumb, beautiful kids who love each other and are violent. You know, I mean, we just love that story.
Mm. We're talking this hour with Stephen March. He's the author of the new book called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. He also writes a column for Esquire magazine. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning. Why do you think Shakespeare is so present today? Why do you think he has spun off into all these different spheres of influence in our world? And just how influential do you think he is? Do you think it does go beyond the stage and the page, as our guest is saying? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the cause, my soul. Let me not name it to you, you chaste stars. It is the cause. Yet I'll not shed her blood, nor scar that whiter skin of hers than snow, and smooth as monumental alabaster. Yet she must die, else she'll betray more men. Put out the light, and then put out the light.
actor Paul Robeson in a clip from Othello. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the influence of Shakespeare with our guest Stephen March. He's the author of the book How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And our phone number, if you want to join in our conversation, is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And this clip we just listened to, this is a strand which I think is particularly hard-hitting in your book. You know, we've talked about starlings and we've talked about teenagers, but you're claiming that Shakespeare, in his play Othello, and the vehicle that became for Paul Robeson, became a crucial part in the way we think about, you know, civil rights.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, this is one of the even weirder stories in the book, because, you know, to me, Othello is a racist play. I mean, it is a play about the barbarism of a black man overcoming his efforts to become civilized, which means being European. But with this play, you know, Paul Robeson said, Othello has set me free. I mean, he believed that play, which when he did it on Broadway, he did it in London in the 30s, and then he did it on Broadway in the 40s, it was the longest running Broadway performance ever up until that point. I mean, just a massive, like 164 continuous performances or something. And then he toured it all through the States and all through Canada. And, you know, he made this, he had this amazing, he became the most famous African-American to date at that point. And, you know, he used Othello essentially as a political tool. You know, he was the first African-American to talk to Major League Baseball owners about desegregation. He was the first, you know, he got, you know, through his efforts, he got Communist Party members elected in Harlem. And he was the first one to really combine, I guess what you would say, the legal claim of, you know, the rights of African Americans with a broad social movement towards social justice. And that, you know, culminates in the civil rights movement. It's a very complicated movement, because Othello is such a, you know, my interpretation of him as racist is one thing, but on the other hand, he's probably the noblest character in Shakespeare. I mean, he is the most eloquent, the most martial, the most plain-spoken. He is a sort of model European gentleman. And so using the nobility of that character to present, you know, even to present an African American hero, just had this immense impact.
Well, it's interesting because if, as you say, this is a racist play, even though the character of Othello is noble, you'd think that that could have gone a different way in terms of influence.
Yeah, I mean, I think it easily could have. I mean, it was a very commonly performed play in the antebellum South. I mean, the thing that was very interesting is that the decision, you know, there was played by white actors, and then, you know, as the Civil War gets closer and closer, the actor playing Othello gets lighter and lighter. I mean, the term Moor, of course, is vague, and you can do it as, you know, more or less an Arab, or you can do it as an African. And, you know, the decision to actually have an African man playing Othello was huge. I mean, it was an immense decision, and when it was done in 1930s in London, it provoked, you know, not, I wouldn't say controversy. I mean, Robeson was a, you know, a great actor, and he gave these totally unforgettable performances. So, you know, it's not that they were critical of him, but there was some question about whether this was possible. An actor tried to do it in England in the 1850s and had been very successful doing it, but he got a lot of... And he could never perform in London or New York. He could never go to America, obviously. And he ended up doing a lot of... His name was Ira Aldridge, and he ended up doing a lot of Shakespeare in whiteface. He ended up playing, like, Shylock and Lear, and there are these amazing photographs of him in those roles that are actually in the book.
Let's take our first phone call now. We have Dennis joining us from West Allis. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, good morning. What a wonderful program, and this book sounds wonderful. I'm going to have to get it and read it. I guess my comment was that it was touched on a bit, is how Shakespeare created language, and not only used it so wonderfully, is that there was no OED or anything, you know, in his time. And I think he was like a quantum force for upgrading the English language, period.
Oh, he had a, this is a chapter, language is a whole chapter in the book. And it's incredible. I mean, etymology is always very vague. I mean, you can't, you know, even modern words, we don't really know who invented them. Like, who invented the word computer, for instance? We don't really know. But Shakespeare was the popularizer or coiner of roughly like around 1,700 words. That's the high end of the estimate, which is really crazy. I mean, it's really nuts. Like, no other writer gets anywhere close to that. The one that always blows me away is the name Jessica. I mean, you know, he invented the name Jessica in Merchant of Venice. No one names their daughter Jessica because they want to sound, you know, highfalutin or educated or Shakespearean or something like that. They just name their daughter Jessica because they love that name. And, you know, he invented it in Merchant of Venice. And he invented a lot of words that, you know, you might surprise you, like advertising and skim milk. You know, he invented skim milk. And I get blown away by these things. But the number of expressions he invented is just incredible. Like the be all and the end all, a snail's pace. I mean, you know, just by the thousands.
Fast and loose, the game is up.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, right?
The truth will out. Yeah, it's amazing that we take these for granted, and we don't know that there's a direct line all the way back to Shakespeare.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, people say, like, oh, well, we don't get Shakespeare because we're not in his language. And I sort of think, well, like, imagine going to a playhouse and hearing the be-all and the end-all for the first time. You know? I mean, it must have been quite an experience. Or a snail's pace for the first time. Or eyeball for the first time. I mean, you know, that must have been, you know, startling in its own way.
Some of those words, I wonder how he could possibly invent them. I mean, some of them are poetic, like the game is up or the be-all, end-all. There's a poetic sensibility there. But
yeah.
What about a word like sanctimonious? How does he come up with sanctimonious?
Well, I think those are the ones I get. I mean, the Latinate ones, you know, where it's like you take sancti, which means holy, and then you take, you know, and you fuse them together and you put a Latinate ending on it. Like consanguineous, you take con, meaning with, you take sang, meaning blood, and then you make an adjectival suffix on the end. I mean, you can do that. You know what I mean? It's words like hobnob or zany.
Right.
Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know where you get that from, you know.
He just apparently felt that he had the inspiration and the wherewithal to do it, and he did it.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, too, I mean, because, you know, the records are so vague, you know, we'll never know, but, I mean, I wonder how much he just heard on the street, you know, and he's the first recorded use of it.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's another possibility that we shouldn't discount. I mean, not that that's lesser, because I don't think it is, to feed off this incredibly fertile environment. But, you know, London in 1590 was a pretty fertile place to be. You know, I mean, a lot of things were going on, and there was a lot of ferment, and I think he definitely fed on that.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Dennis, and we'll move next to Lucia in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello.
Hi there. As an English graduate student, I am just so refreshed by this conversation and by your work, Stephen March, and I am sitting here and thinking about what would it be like if some of Shakespeare's contemporaries, as you suggested earlier, were sort of what we dig into for our influence. Like, what if Christopher Marlowe, for example, was like, gave us a bird that we populated to, you know, negative consequence? What if Dante, you know, it seems like what you're suggesting is that Shakespeare's His influence is sort of disproportionate to his talent. I don't know if that's a bad way of putting it, but if that's the case, then I'm just sitting here thinking about, like, why is it that, what is it about Shakespeare that has made us sort of canonize him? Is it like that he, for example, like you were just suggesting and Dennis was suggesting, the earlier caller, that he invented a bunch of words? Because, you know, like Lewis Carroll and James Joyce did that. Or is it because, you know, the Elizabethan throne, like, lavished him with lots of great opportunities? Or is it because, you know, he ushered in you know, he was sort of like ushering in modern English. And was it a great biographer who picked him up? Like, I'm just trying to figure out, like, because in English, like, academic circles, you know, he's canonized, you know, as this great figure. Like, as an undergraduate, like, I had to worship Shakespeare in order to get anywhere. And I'm just thinking, like, I would love to worship somebody else, but I don't have that choice now. You know what I mean? So this is so refreshing to hear, like, it was, maybe it was random, you know? Well, like, so what do you think about that?
Well, this is the big question of the book. I mean, you know this as a graduate student. You know, when I was doing my PhD, you sort of discover, like, oh, my God, Christopher Marlowe is this unbelievable playwright. John Webster is this unbelievable playwright. Thomas Middleton is this unbelievable playwright. Thomas Middleton didn't even have his works collected in a reliable edition until 2008. I mean, you know, I would say about writers like Joyce who invented words, you know, those words didn't stick. So those are neologisms. They're not really the kind of same coinage that we're getting with Shakespeare. But it is a big question. I mean, the first English classes ever taught, which were only in the late 19th century. I mean, you know, English literature as an appropriate field for study was really quite recent. The first course taught was Shakespeare. It was felt that Shakespeare was the only modern writer who could sort of compete with the ancients, you know, compete with Sophocles and Aeschylus and people like this. This is the question that has concerned me. Is it just institutional? I mean, is it just that, you know, you have the British Navy going down the river, bringing Shakespeare with them like they brought the Bible, forcing it onto people's... But, you know, I mean, the thing is, when I did the research, it just wasn't true. Like, he did spread of his own accord. The Indians loved him. I mean, they converted him on their own right to these, like, six-hour musical tragic comedies. There's a Hamlet that's like a six-hour musical version that was performed all over India. There was, you know, he was the most popular 19th century playwright in Japan. In the Wild West, in places like Nevada City, touring Boston families would come and make small fortunes. One of them made $60,000 in a season in the 1850s, touring these like remote mining towns where Shakespeare was absolutely on par with prostitutes and alcohol and booze, alcohol and booze are the same thing, and gambling, I guess, as an avenue of pleasure. So, you know, I mean, the answer that I come to in the book, which is only really half satisfying. I mean, there are all these random accidents, but I think it's the completeness of Shakespeare's vision. I mean, I think it has something to do with the fact that if you have the complete works of Shakespeare, you have 13-year-old girls, you have old saints, you have nasty Jewish guys, you have people, you have all these different types of humanity. And so what you get in Shakespeare is a kind of mirror of the human condition. And that is, I think, incredibly powerful. But that's the answer I come up with. But, you know, I take your point. I mean, this is not a book about, like, Shakespeare is so amazing that, although he is amazing, don't get me wrong, but the amount of power that he had, the amount of influence that he has had is completely disproportionate to his relation to anyone else. Because I don't really see how any other writer really changed material history, whereas Shakespeare changed it a lot, an enormous amount. And so, yeah, I think disproportionate is the right adjective. Was that a correct answer?
Well, thank you, Lucia. What do you think about that answer?
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Great work. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. You know, it's interesting because before speaking with you, reading this book, I would have said that Shakespeare had a huge influence because he was such a humanist, because he wrote with such compassion about people, and he seemed to understand things about the human soul that nobody else could articulate or understand, regardless of how fine a writer they were.
Yeah.
Are you saying that's not true?
No, I think that is true. I just think, you know, there are a lot of humanistic writers out there. You know, I mean, Joyce had this incredible insight into humanity as well. So did Dante. But I don't think you can really find the impact the same way that Shakespeare had. And, his humanism, you know, there are parts in the book where it's clear that his incredible, you know, I mean, we were talking about Othello beforehand, right? And, I mean, I think even though Othello is a racist play, you know, the humanism that forces Shakespeare, or does it force him? But I guess it allows Shakespeare to make an African character fully human, you know, fully, you know, realistic and human, is what sort of saves him in the end. It's what makes this character so viable in times that he could never have imagined. And the big example of that is Sex, of course, where he had this immense impact on Sex, mainly because he's just so frank about it and so humanistic about it. So I think, you know, there his humanism definitely has a role, but I don't think that really explains fully why he's had this magical impact.
We're talking this hour with Stephen March. He's the author of the new book, How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And we're looking forward to hearing from more of you this morning. Why do you think Shakespeare has had such a powerful influence on our world? And do you think that there's a reason for that? What is your answer? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. You can shoot us an email there as well. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I am a Jew. Hath of a Jew eyes? Hath of a Jew hands? Organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge?
A clip from The Merchant of Venice by, of course, William Shakespeare. Our guest this morning is Stephen March. He's the author of How Shakespeare Changed Everything. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Stephen, Merchant of Venice is another difficult play. You know, personally for me, the last time I saw it, which was a long time ago, I pretty much decided I never wanted to see it again, and I wasn't sure anyone should be performing it anymore.
Yeah.
What is your take on Merchant of Venice?
Well, I know how you feel. I mean, you know, it's like Othello to me. I mean, it doesn't make sense unless you have anti-Semitic prejudices, right? I mean, it doesn't work unless you sort of admit those. However, fascinating story. I mean, the Nazis were crazy about Shakespeare. Joseph Goebbels, actually, his favorite professor at the University of Heidelberg, was a Jewish guy who wrote a book called Shakespeare, a Germanic Writer. I mean, just, you couldn't make this stuff up, right? I mean, it's just so grotesque. But the thing that was fascinating is, you know, in 1933, there were more performances of Shakespeare in Germany than there were in the rest of the world combined. Germans have always sort of felt that Shakespeare is only accidentally an English writer. I mean, they feel that he belongs in this very clear German tradition, and that the fact that he happened to write in English is just accident. So the one play that they really couldn't perform was Merchant of Venice. I mean, you would think that, you know, it's beautiful. We got this anti-Semitic play. It's by Shakespeare. Let's do it. No, it was the second least performed play in Nazi Germany, and there are a couple of reasons for it. I mean, one of the reasons is you can't really cut any of Shylock's lines because he only has five scenes in the play, and so if you cut anything, it is a really pared down character, so it's very hard to cut. And then the other thing is that his daughter Jessica is breaking the Nazi racial laws by marrying a Christian. And so, you know, when you read the history of the performance of Merchant of Venice in Germany, for instance, like, after the war, you have all these expiation Shylocks, that's what they call them. Like, you'll have an avant-garde performance of Merchant of Venice where they'll set it in a concentration camp. And, you know, but the truth of the matter is that no one would have been more offended by the actual Merchant of Venice than a Nazi. You know, this is the And while he was loved by the Nazis, he was also he was adored by the communists. He was translated into all 28 languages of the USSR. He was elevated to this. It's horrible. I mean, it's not funny. I shouldn't laugh. But they had this bureaucratic categories of thinkers in the Soviet Union, and at the top of it was the great thinkers of the age, which included Lenin and Stalin and Shakespeare. And the politics of Shakespeare is almost impossible to discover. I mean, if you think of World War II, every side, Winston Churchill, Hitler, and Stalin, I mean, virtually the only thing they agreed on was that they adored Shakespeare. So, his politics are, while I was talking about in this book about his immense power over in the world, when you actually look at his influence on politics, that's the one place where it's really hard to find out what his influence was.
And he himself, I guess we don't know that much about his politics.
A working playwright in the 16th, 17th century could not afford to have politics. I mean, that was a good way to get a sword in the eye, as happened with Christopher Marlowe. Thomas Middleton, who we're talking about, he put on a very political play called A Game of Chess, and it was shut down. I think it was two performances, and then it was never performed again until, modern times. Shakespeare's politics of his own time is unknowable. I mean, simply unknowable. I don't think it's even consequent. I don't even think he had politics. That's my opinion.
Well, we've got a lot of callers waiting to talk to you, so let's try to get to some of those. We have first Vivian in Deerfield, Illinois. Hello.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just so excited to talk to you. I have the book, and I started reading. I had to put it on pause because I realized I haven't really brushed up my Shakespeare, so to speak, since high school. So I'm desperately trying to find my own copy of the complete works, which I have somewhere packed up, and I've just been looking for it this week, as a matter of fact, so this is very timely. I happen to work for some attorneys, and we were discussing that I'm reading the book, and that I encouraged, I said, oh, this is going to be fascinating, and so far. And we were talking about The Merchant of Venice. I'm just looking forward to finishing the book. It's captured me already, and it has inspired me to get back into my Shakespeare.
I hope you're not going to read all 36 plays.
I'm going to intersperse them because I want to complete your book as well. But the last time I ever had any exposure was when I was in West Side Story, and I was fascinated.
Right.
That was there, the connection to Romeo and Juliet. So, at any rate, thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh my goodness! Thank you so much for reading it. Pleasure. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for the call, Vivian. And we'll move to Karen in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Veronica, very interesting show.
Thanks.
My background is as an English teacher, and I've always believed that plays were meant to be seen, not just read. And so my high school students used to act out the Shakespeare plays. And these were not like all advanced students either. We had so much fun. On the day before we were going to assassinate Julius Caesar, all the boys in the class wanted to be assassins, and they came the next day with little cardboard knives that they had cut out, and it was very, very exciting. We live near Winona, Minnesota, and for the past 8 years now, there has been here in Winona the most wonderful experience. It's the Great River Shakespeare Festival. It's a professional troupe who comes in May and they stay until the beginning of August. They prepare two Shakespeare plays, and now they've been doing one other this summer. It's Henry IV, Part One, and it's also Midsummer Night's Dream, and then they are doing a musical, which is The Fantastics, this summer. We started taking our granddaughter, who was 8 years old at the time, to some of these plays, and she last year saw The Comedy of Errors, and we heard all year long lines from The Comedy of Errors.
Really?
That made such an impression on her, and she would sometimes just mimic some of the gestures that some of the actors had doing, and we would all burst out laughing because we remembered those scenes so well. she went this summer to see Midsummer Night's Dream, and she couldn't wait to go. We are bringing our 5-year-old and 7-year-old grandsons on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday evening, to a performance of Midsummer Night's Dream, and we're telling them, you know, a summary of the story ahead of time, but we know that they are just going to die laughing about the mechanicals and so forth. And I have to say, in my experience as a teacher, and also especially in my experience here watching the Great River Shakespeare Festival plays, it's the breadth of Shakespeare's words, and the stories weren't all his. We know that he
wrote
stories, but the depth of characters. And last year, Othello was one of the plays. It was magnificent, and the young man who played Othello was so multi-layered in his presentation.
Let's get our guest in on this a little bit. What do you think about the breadth of Shakespeare and seeing it performed live, Stephen?
Well, I love it. I mean, I'm always amazed at how people respond to it. I mean, you know, I think you get into academia and you start to wonder, you get into weird plays and you like things that are really unusual, and, you know, but you, when you go to see these, like Midsummer Night's Dream is just a joy machine. You know, I mean, it is just like a, it just really, really works. It really, really makes people happy. And, you know, you can get caught up in thinking like, oh, this is a little elite specialist movement around some old guys who are dead, and we're all, you know, obsessed with them. But, like, actually, he actually really feeds something that audiences need. And it's just amazing to see.
Well, thank you so much, Karen, and I hope you enjoy your Shakespeare going this season as well. And we move to Carol from Muscadet. Hi, Carol.
Yes, thank you. First, a comment and then a question. The like all great philosophers, and I think of Shakespeare as a philosopher, he's beyond politics in the respect you were referring to earlier. Or alternatively, it's the politics that he's into that are the deepest sense of politics for me. When I'm observing, you know, what he has to say and various presentations of what he says. And while it's easy to complain about the racism in Othello and the anti-Semitism in Merchant and so on, it's also interesting to note that, like philosophers, he raises questions. He more than he provides answers, and thus the everlasting life in these works, because we are dealing with the same questions today that he dealt with, et cetera, and in all the different countries, and et cetera. And it's so interesting what you said about the Nazis. Makes absolute sense to me. But anyway, last night I saw Taming of the Shrew at the American Players, which is this lovely place in Spring Green out under the stars, and the production was brilliant. It was just so original, so imaginative piece of work, and this is exactly what it did. It raised the questions. It's not easy to say, oh, this is a sexist play.
Yeah.
It's not easy to say it's not a sexist play. I mean,
what do you think the questions,
et cetera.
Carol, what do you think the questions are in Taming of the Shrew?
Well, the relations, the relationship between the sexes and the power balance and the what it means to be domineering. Does that mean you're strong or does that mean you're weak? You know, all these eternal questions about human relationships, and not just within a couple, but, you know, within all kinds of groups, etc. And, you know, it doesn't have easy answers. You can interpret it in so many different ways, as critics have, you know. So what I'm interested in hearing is your guest's take on Taming of the Shrew.
Okay, thank you, Carol. We've got about a minute left, maybe a little less, for your answer, Stephen.
A minute for Taming of
the
Shrew.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I mean, it's as you say, it's one of these great plays that is so complex and so original and asks questions that won't go away. I mean, I think when I tried to come to an answer to why Shakespeare was so powerful, I mean, why it was so influential, it's exactly that. You know, the difficulties of his play, rather than their simplicity, that makes him, you know, so influential. Because it's the difficulties rather than the complexities rather than the simplicities that are fascinating about human beings, I guess.
Well, Stephen March, this has been a great hour. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Real pleasure, Veronica.
Our guest this hour, Stephen March. He is the author of the book we've been discussing. It's called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. Stephen March is an author and a journalist, and he currently writes a column for Esquire magazine. And by the way, if you were inspired by this hour, you can download Shakespeare's complete works for free on many sites on the internet, including iBooks. Thanks to Jennifer Dargan and Joe Hartke and Rhonda Fanning for production this hour. I'm Veronica Rickard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.